Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Today we're going to talk about abstinence teaching, a huge shift in sex education. Our guest speaker is Executive Director Valerie Hubert. She's going to be our guest for the next 25 minutes. If you'd like to join in the conversation, please call 347-324-3460, 347-324-3460, and she's with the National Abstinence Education Association. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I guess to begin with, our listeners like to hear personal stories about the person. So, if you don't mind, kind of tell us about yourself.
Sure. Before directing the National Abstinence Education Association, I was the person responsible for managing the abstinence education program for the state of Ohio. Working out of the Ohio Department of Health, and at that time, I really learned that this is an issue that unfortunately is not only contentious, but that it fits really well within a public health model for encouraging best health outcomes. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't make that connection. I really initially got interested in this whole topic because I have four children and certainly want to make sure that what they are learning, outside of the home is reinforcing those healthy messages that we are communicating in the home. And so based on that concern, it kind of launched me into the broader conversation of what should the message be for all teens and all young people, and then currently what should our federal sex education policy be, and if it is not healthy, we need to be involved in changing it to make sure it is.
Wow. And the organization, the NAEA, kind of tell about us the history of that particular organization.
Sure. Well, we're a little over 5 years old now, and when the founders of this organization got together, they recognized that although abstinence education or the value of promoting abstinence to young people is kind of one of those no-brainer intuitive things, we were losing the whole debate in the public conversation, and it wasn't because it didn't have value, it wasn't because it didn't work, it was because those who were providing abstinence education were busy in their communities and in their schools and in their homes, making a difference in young people's lives, but not involved so much in the cultural debate, in the general conversation, and certainly not in public policy. And so this debate was being defined, and abstinence education was being misdefined by our opponents. So NAEA was formed to correct a lot of that misinformation and to have a very specific voice in favor of best health outcomes for young people at the national, state, and even the local levels, and to really change this debate based on not sound bites, but on truly what kind of things are going to be in the best interest of our young people, and what kind of things could be defined as a good use of our hard-earned taxpayer dollars rather than just pushing a political agenda.
What is the administration's view on this particular program right now? Are they the health department is really promoting it? Or?
Well, that's a really good question. What we have found ever since sex education has been federally funded in recent years, which was really started under the Reagan administration, and then it got another boost under the Clinton administration, and another boost under the Bush administration. That's for abstinence education. But sex education in general has been funded since the time of Johnson and, you know, right around that time, and even earlier on a little bit different level since around World War One. Well, what we found is it really didn't matter if there was a Republican or a Democrat in the White House, there was support for abstinence education. Currently, however, we find that we've broken with tradition. And President Obama sought to eliminate all abstinence education from federal sex education policy as soon as he took office. And so because of some bipartisan efforts that we've worked very hard to develop in Congress, we were able to restore a little bit of priority. But there's still like a 16-to-1 disparity between contraceptive sex education and abstinence education, which is really a tragedy and a travesty if we're really concerned about the health of young people. And the reality is, whatever federal sex ed policy is, it has a trickle-down effect to the states and to the communities, because we know that many communities and even states are financially strapped. And so as a result of that, you know, they're kind of like the squirrel that follows wherever he can find his, you know, next nut. In this regard, they're following the money, and unfortunately, some states and some communities and even some schools are less concerned about the content of what that education looks like as much as the dollars that are behind it. And so we've seen a major shift as a result of federal sex ed policy trickling down to offer less than optimal health choices for the youth in those locales.
Well, why the administration cut back the program? Is it because of financing or finances, or is it something political, or just something they just wanted to take out, or something was just ill-advised?
Well, we think it's very ill-advised. We think that it's a very sharp ideological turn where there's less of a concern, unfortunately, about looking at this issue from an objective standpoint and more about thinking of the political base and being willing to make decisions based on those sound bites rather than the reality. And the administration described the rationale for their doing so by saying, you know, we only want to fund the things that work, and clearly abstinence education doesn't work, and so it would be a waste of taxpayer dollars to devote any funding toward that. Well, it makes for a rather convincing sound bite and talking point until you look at the research and you find that the whole basis supposedly for their eliminating abstinence education is on pretty shaky ground, because there's some pretty impressive research showing that not only is abstinence education intuitively something that, you know, works every single time, abstinence does, but from an implementation standpoint, we have a pretty sizable body of research that shows that young people who are part of abstinence education classes and programs are much more likely to delay sex, and if they are already sexually active, they're more likely to discontinue that sexual activity. So it's one of those things that doesn't make a lot of logical sense when you really start digging.
Are kids waiting, or is the... I can remember the 80s when we had an uptick on teen pregnancies, and we had, you know, I remember that show with Charlie on CBS, talking about teen pregnancies and just mushroomed from there. And it was a topic probably 85 or 86 or 87. During that time, we also had the HIV epidemic happening. Has things really changed that much? Teen pregnancies have gone down and it's showing that all of a sudden now we're beginning to wait?
Well, you know, the typical understanding of this whole issue, if you were to ask the average American, they would say that mm-hmm. probably teen pregnancy is at its all-time high and teen sexual activity is at its all-time high, and that most teens, you know, are going to have sex, so abstinence education is unrealistic. That's kind of the conventional comment about this. But here again, let's look at the trends. And you're right, there was a big uptick in the 80s, and as a result of that, President Clinton signed some legislation that inaugurated at that time one of the largest abstinence education programs ever. And it was because they saw, the president and Congress saw a big correlation between the ever-expanding welfare rolls and single parenting. And so they really wanted to get to the core of the issue, which was to encourage non-married, particularly young people, to wait to have sex until they're married. And as a result of that and some other things, we have seen dramatic drops in not only teen pregnancy, but I think even more telling in teen sexual initiation. So we are right now at the lowest level, I think, of teen birth that we have had in decades. In addition to that, and again, I think it's more telling because it really speaks to the behavior, more and more teens are choosing to wait to have sex altogether. So if you look at the teens that are most, the age group that's most typically targeted for a sex ed class, let's say in schools, 15 to 17-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
The CDC released some numbers not long ago that showed almost 75% of that age group has never had sex. So that is very encouraging information, and it really flies in the face of what most people would think. And in addition to that, it kind of begs the question, if 75% of 15 to 17-year-olds have never had sex, then why is it that the priority in our sex education policy here for the nation is doing very little to reinforce those healthy behaviors or to increase those numbers even further? I think it shows a disconnect between what is resonating with our youth and what kind of agenda we have currently as a nation for sex ed.
That's pretty good. I mean, granted, since the video movement for the past 25 years, and now you have the internet, you have a lot of things that before really 85, nobody really had access to. Today they have access to the world. You know, you can mistype something and come up with something on the internet, and you have peer pressure today, a lot of stimulation, and it's pretty good that they're still holding off. If you had to have a conversation as a parent with a child, what would you say? Because some parents are really, really afraid to even talk about sex. They just can't imagine their baby engaging in this activity until they are married or well into their adulthood. What do you say to that parent how to open this conversation as a couple and to have this conversation with your teen? What will you say to them?
Well, that is a really good question, too. We really encourage parents to be the primary sex educators of their children. And what your listeners might find interesting is that without exception, whenever teens are asked where they want to get this information, where they want to go to talk about, you know, setting dating guidelines, talk about relationships, talk about sex, The number one choice is always mom or dad, always.
Wow.
I think that that information should be really empowering to parents, because a lot of parents that I talk to think that their teens either aren't listening to them, or even if they hear, they really don't care what they have to say. Those surveys, and not just one, but many of them, paint a very different picture. But the fact of the matter is if mom or dad or mom and dad aren't saying much, then the reality is that the teen is going to find that information elsewhere, whether it's on the internet or from friends or peers. And that information might be inaccurate, it might be unhealthy, and it might be guiding them in a direction that they shouldn't be going and that their parents wish they wouldn't go. So that's not an exact answer to your question, but then let's look a little deeper.
Mm-hmm.
We really encourage this conversation not to be a single conversation, but that it begins with an openness and an ability for even a very young person to ask a question, any question, to mom and dad, and be able to get an age-appropriate answer, so that when they enter the more awkward teen years, when the questions get a lot more difficult, they will feel safe to do that. It's very important that parents communicate their values, but do so in a non-threatening way, but all the while still communicating expectations, because a whole lot of other research also shows that teens who receive very clear direction and expectations in this area from their parents are much, much more likely to wait to have sex. So that's kind of a summary, and there are a lot of things to fill in, but that should get things started a little bit.
Okay. Is there a particular age that you need to start this conversation?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's really important to be sensitive to the questions that children have at any age. So, you know, if a five-year-old sees that their best friend's mom is expecting and has a question about something about, you know, how does that baby come out, or, you know, is it going to be a boy or a girl or whatever, to have an age-appropriate response. That doesn't mean you pull out the charts and you pull out the books and go into every detail, but you give a very simple response that satisfies their question, as a satisfactory answer to their question, and that's it. Now, you know, a couple of years later, they might have that same question but need a little more information. So you're building on the information, but in an age-appropriate way. And so then, you know, when a child is approaching puberty, then it becomes much more natural to talk about that. And then when you're talking about, you know, the possibility of group dating or, you know, an interest in a boy or a girl, then you already have some foundation for having these sensitive conversations, and there is a comfort level on both sides. I think another really important thing to mention is a lot of parents are very uncomfortable with this topic, first of all, because it is, you know, it's a very personal and sensitive issue. But a lot of parents may have engaged in some things themselves when they were teens that they're not especially proud of right now. They kind of feel hypocritical if they set some standards that maybe they didn't follow themselves when they were a teen. We really like to encourage parents to realize that they have matured and learned some things, and that their children don't need to repeat their same mistakes for them to learn those same lessons. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can think about this in a number of issues. What child hasn't told a lie or done something, and yet when we are adults, even though we lied, we still have an expectation for honesty for our children. Well, the same thing is true here, that we can, it's not hypocrisy. It really is maturity and wanting something different and better for our own children, and it can really become a foundation or a basis for those conversations rather than stifling them.
Wow. It's kind of ironic. It's almost like it can happen at any age. And I can remember in the 70s that, you know, the simple explanation that kids usually figure out, hey, the baby comes from, you know, you just cut out your stomach. And it made sense. And no other questions about it until I actually, one of my friend's parents was a nurse, and she actually explained, and actually, when she had that baby, she was in the delivery room with him. Does scare tactics work? I mean, there used to be a scare tactic, okay, you can die from this. Getting pregnant is painful. All of those type of things. Has research show that those negative things really deter them at all?
Well, what we found for massive campaigns, let's just look at this anti-smoking campaign, for example.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most recent changes in that campaign was encouraging very graphic pictures on the sides of cigarette packs to show some of the consequences of smoking. And usually they're the most extreme consequences that you would find. When HIV/AIDS was first discovered in the 80s, the medical community was learning about it at the same time the general public was, and so there was a lot of misinformation, but one thing was clear, and that was this is something that can kill you, and it is killing people, and while we don't know everything about it, we do know that if you get it, your prognosis isn't very good. This was back in the 80s, of course. We also, though, know that information alone isn't particularly impactful by itself in changing somebody's behavior because
mm-hmm.
they need to personalize it for themselves. That's why physicians, for example, still engage in really unhealthy activities even though they know the medical consequences. And you can find other examples as well. There has to be a personal motivation and connection. And the thing that I think is uniquely good about an abstinence education program is we're not just talking about here's why you need to wait to have sex, and we talk about all of the sexually transmitted disease and it is stark and it is horrifying, but there are other reasons, because a teen doesn't think that those kind of things are going to happen to them. It might happen to
Wow.
their friend who isn't as smart, but it's not going to happen to them. But if you can make this conversation contextual and encourage a young person to think of their future, what kind of things they'd like to accomplish in the next 10 years, for example. And once they begin to envision their future, then they realize that there are some things that they need to say, I'm not going to engage in this or this, and I am going to make a priority of this, and here are some things that could really get me off track, and they're then putting together a roadmap for their future, and they can see why for them, adding sex to a relationship really could mess up a lot of things, not just for me, but for the other person as well. And then it becomes important to them. So while, you know, some people call talking about the stark realities of sexually transmitted disease or whatever as a scare tactic, we would say, you know, it's reality. One in
mm-hmm.
14 girls has at least one sexually transmitted disease, and some of them, if you have them, they can cause cancer, they can have very bad consequences as a result. They can make you unable to have children. But we don't end the conversation there. We really contextualize it and make it a conversation where teens are living, talking about healthy relationships and how adding sex to that relationship at their age can really derail even you know, relationships that could have a future. They could sustain really unhealthy ones, and you don't want that to happen. So I think it's really important to have this conversation as a holistic conversation where you're talking about how one physical act can impact an entire life for good or for bad.
Wow. What do you would like to leave us with, and with the whole conversation about what we need to do as parents and where we headed as a society?
Sure. Well, obviously, we are the biggest cheerleaders for parents, and I know it's a tough job. And so we have some resources on our sister website for our foundation at abstinenceworks.org that give parents not only some conversation starters, it also gives them some clues of what kind of questions to ask the health class or the sex ed teacher in their school to find out what kind of things are actually being taught, because you as parents need to be the advocates for your children. And then on a national level, I really would encourage your listeners to contact their members of Congress and say, you know, our federal sex ed policy right now, it's wrongheaded. It is not encouraging best health outcomes for my children, and I want to see a change. I want an abstinence-centered approach to be given priority so that we can see even more than 75% of those 15 to 17-year-olds saying, I'm going to wait, and I know why I'm waiting, and they're going to do it successfully.
Wow. And give us your contact information, your two websites.
Sure. The website for NAEA is thenaea.org www.thenaea.org. And for NAEF, it is abstinenceworks.org.
Perfect. Well, Valerie, I really appreciate you joining the conversation today. Thank you so very much for coming onto the program.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to chatting again sometime.
Thank you again. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, it's been another production of the Core Business Show. You can download this episode on Block Talk Radio and iTunes. Thank you you all for listening, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to the Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.